This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Nigeria, a dangerous crowd surrounds the hut sheltering a 5-year-old girl accused of being a witch. A colorful dish with roots in the gold mines of South Africa.
This is my la piche de la résistance. It is my spice. It's a very mild curry.
The music of a Brazilian superstar turned politician, and the music of someone a bit less well known. Around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Things are getting better for the people of Iraq. That's the finding of a new ABC News poll.
59% of Iraqis now say they feel very safe in their communities. And 65% say things are going well in their own lives. Both numbers up dramatically.
The poll found that not only has security improved in Iraq, but so has the country's infrastructure. This is all good news. But there's still a segment of the Iraqi population facing enormous difficulties. A different survey, this one done by the charity group Oxfam, found that many women in Iraq aren't faring so well. Oxfam's Jennifer Abrahamson joins us from her office in London. Are women affected disproportionately in Iraq?
Well, what we found is because of the violence, so many people have been killed or have been injured, that a staggering number of women are now really carrying the burden of supporting families on their shoulders.
So we're talking about a lot of widows here.
Exactly. There are different estimates of the number of widows in the country, but one that the New York Times came out with recently was roughly 750,000. And if you do the math around that, that affects probably hundreds of thousands of more people, because many of these women support children or supporting extended families. Often they haven't worked before, and for the most part, these women are receiving no state support from the Iraqi government, and they're left completely unable to pay for electricity, for water, school fees, health care. So what we've seen over the last years, with more and more men really being absent from the equation, is really a decline in the living standards to a real what we're calling a silent emergency for women and their families.
Is there anything underway that will remedy this problem?
Well, there have been some positive steps. I think I'd like to point out, of course, you know, as everybody knows, the insecurity in Iraq has been the primary focus over the last years. And what we're saying is that there was sort of a window of opportunity that has opened now, and that the Iraqi government faced many, many challenges over the last years, but they need to begin investing some oil revenue. Even though the cost or the global price of oil has decreased, the Iraqi government has more access to those oil revenues than they have ever before. And if they want to invest in their country and really get onto the road to a more stable future, now is the time to begin really hammering out a strategic plan and how to rebuild the country, to get the schools running again, to get women into the workplace, to pay out pensions to these hundreds of thousands of women who have no other source of income. I think, again, once state support, we hope, kicks in, there will be vocational training. And many of these women, their husbands supported them in the past. They don't have the skills to go into the workplace even if they wanted to. So they need vocational training, they need support, and they need protection measures so they can feel safe and free to be able to work and support their families and start paying for school fees.
Why would the Iraqi government put women at the top of the list or make them a priority when there are so many other needs there?
Well, again, I think the women now, in many ways and in many, many families, are representing the families of Iraq. As I've mentioned before, so many men are no longer part of those families. They are not going to be leading the children into the future and into the next generation of Iraq, into a prosperous, educated workforce. It's now the women who are running these families, who are supporting these families. And so I think what we're facing is really a chronic problem. This is not something that's going to go away overnight. You know, it's fantastic news that the security situation has improved, but to get these families back into functioning society, there is going to need to be a full effort to support them. It's absolutely crucial that they receive the attention, the resources, and the support that can make that happen.
Jennifer, before your survey was released, the Iraqi Minister for Women's Rights resigned in protest because she said she didn't have enough money and not enough government support to deal with the enormous problems women in Iraq were facing. But I understand that since your report was released, she's actually done an about-face. What's the story behind that?
She tendered her resignation in early February of this year, really in protest. She clearly stated that. It was reported in the media that there were an army of women who she wanted to help, but she was completely ill-equipped to do so because she just didn't have the resources. We issued our report about a month later on March 8th, International Women's Day. And the following day, on the 9th, she did make an announcement, which was covered in the media, that she had received some donations from international aid agencies and that she was going to withdraw her resignation because she saw that, to a degree, the international community was rallying behind her cause. But it was very inspiring news that perhaps people will be, around the world, will be focusing on the importance of women in Iraq.
Jennifer Abrahamson of Oxfam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Abrahamson wrote the Oxfam report called In Her Own Words, Iraqi Women Talk About Their Challenges and Concerns. And while Iraqi women face struggles in their country, Iraqis in exile are dealing with challenges of their own. There are more than 1 million Iraqi refugees in Syria. Many of them are asking the question where and how to go to college. Education is expensive in Syria. Most refugees can't afford it. But an American couple in Damascus is opening doors for Iraqi refugees who want to go to college in America. Will Everett reports.
A half dozen students mingle in an apartment in downtown Damascus, chatting in Arabic. Dressed in jeans, dresses, and sweaters, they might be students anywhere, but they share one thing in common. They're all refugees, and they're here hoping for a fresh start.
Yeah, everything's fine, but after the word father, add in Arabic.
Okay.
And I didn't mark this, but
that's Gabe Huck. He and Teresa Kubasak are a retired American couple who hope to get these young people into American colleges. The students have been meeting in their apartment a few times a week to prepare for the English exam they must take.
How many times did you rewrite this essay, do you think?
Maybe 8 or 7 times, I don't know.
Yeah, 7 or 8 times.
Yeah.
And now it feels like in the final stage. I think they're going to be.
These students are participants in the Iraqi Student Project. Huck and Kubasak started the project here 2 years ago. They retired to Damascus in 2005 because they wanted to help Iraqi refugees here. At first, they weren't sure how to do that. Then, a year later,
came on this idea of these young people who had either not been able to start college or not been able to continue in college in Iraq because of the violence.
The Iraqi Student Project does 2 things. It gets schools to waive some or all tuition, but first it helps qualified students overcome the hurdles involved in getting accepted at an American college.
You have to register online with a credit card. The kids are refugees. How can they do that? It was almost like a game for us. Okay, here's the next hurdle. Let's jump over it. How can we get through this?
One of the students the project is currently helping is 19-year-old Fuhad.
Hi, Fuhad.
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, Fuhad. Welcome.
Fuhad is trying to get into Tufts University in Massachusetts and needs help with one of his entrance essays. They've been working on it for a couple of weeks.
How do you think it's going?
It's going to be good.
Good.
I hope so.
Let's read it out loud and sort of see where anything more is needed. All this first started when I was in Iraq after the war in 2003. Going to school was very dangerous because schools were easy targets for car bombs without protection.
Fuhad fled Iraq with his family in 2005. He finished high school in Damascus, but his family couldn't afford to send him to college here. So he went to work instead to help his family get by. His essay describes working 12-hour days in a cake shop. In his free time, he studies English through a program at the British Consulate. That's where he heard about the Iraqi Student Project. He'd like to study in America and bring his skills back home to help rebuild his country.
I'm thinking about studying engineering and especially architecture. And I'd like to go back to Iraq and Reno what have been destroyed.
Last year, the Iraqi Student Project helped get 14 Iraqis into American schools. Since then, it's been bombarded with requests. A few days later, Kubasak and Huck meet with Fuhad's family. His essay is finished. Now it's time to fill out the financial portion of the application.
How much did your family spend during 2008 on the rent?
It's about £8,000.
So that would be...
The application asks things like how much the family spends on car repairs and how much they pay their servants. That one got a good laugh. Fuhad's mother, dressed in a conservative head covering, knows that soon, with any luck, her son may be leaving. But she's not hesitant about saying goodbye. He doesn't need to stay with me all his life, she says. It's not an easy thing to say goodbye for 4 years, but if he's not educated, he can't help his country. Fuhad's 10-year-old brother Osama says it's going to be more difficult for him saying goodbye. But he's been wanting to meet the American couple so that maybe one day he too could study in the U.S.
I always tell my brother Fuad, I want to meet you.
Oh, well, here we are.
Good. Yes.
Well,
okay. Fuhad passes around pastries that he made on his latest 12-hour shift at the cake shop, a job he says he won't miss. He says he's ready to get on with his life.
This is the one chance that I got. I have no alternative but this. It's been 2 years without college. 2 years is a very long time, and I'm running out of time.
For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett in Damascus, Syria.
We just heard from a 10-year-old boy in Will's piece. Later in the show, we'll get to know Osama a little better through his art. Coming up, an entire city comes to a halt every month to clean.
I've been cleaning out the gutters and then cleaned my surroundings. Basically, that's what I've been doing, and I did my laundry. That's all. That's all.
That's right after the break. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire.
Okay. So do you believe that you are a witch?
You're listening to a scene from the recent British documentary called Saving Africa's Witch Children.
I want you to know, Mary, that we don't believe that you are a witch. What we believe is that you are a beautiful, fine, fine girl.
It takes place in Nigeria, where children are sometimes accused of being witches, even babies a few months old. What happens to these children is often horrifying. They can have acid thrown on them or be burned alive. Sometimes they're abandoned by their parents and thrown out of their villages. And that's what's happened to 5-year-old Mary. In this scene from the film, an ominous crowd gathers outside a hut where she's being temporarily sheltered.
Well, she's like a 5-year-old girl on her own on the street, clearly like massively more vulnerable to like traffickers and rapists and everything than boys would be.
That's Gary Foxcroft talking. He runs a British charity called Stepping Stones Nigeria. It helps children who've been accused of being witches. Foxcroft tells us a bit more about the 5-year-old girl in this documentary.
Mary was living on the streets on her own. And when we were carrying out some research there, she just ended up following us around. And we then set about trying to reunite her with her parents, and the documentary shows us going with her to a rural village and looking for her family. And none of her immediate family were there, but their extended family wouldn't accept her back because they said that she was a witch.
5 years old, this little girl.
Yes, she's only 5 years old. But I mean, after we tried to reunite Mary with her parents, like I said, we couldn't find them, so we took her back to the shelter, provided her with clothing and nutritional support. She's now at school. She's a completely different child. I mean, you often see a very, very dramatic change in these children from the generally malnourished, impoverished state that you often find them in to a much happier, healthier state within 3 to 6 months. But, you know, we would argue that religious profiteering is one of the primary sort of driving forces behind the belief, in that many of the pastors who stigmatize children as witches then go on to demand very high fees from the parents or the guardians of the children in order to exorcise them.
How do these religious leaders take a five-year-old child and determine that it's a witch? Is there something, is it misbehavior on the child's part? Is there something about the child's personality?
Yes, often there's something about the child that will set the child aside from other children. So, for example, a very common ailment that is associated with witchcraft would be epilepsy. So if a child has epileptic fits in the night, they would be perceived to be a child witch, or maybe they wet the bed at night. And, you know, people, if they die from HIV/AIDS, or maybe there's a car accident, maybe somebody loses their job, any form of, you know, unfortunate circumstances would then be blamed on the activities of these so-called child witches.
And as you mentioned, you do try to reunite them with their families. In Mary's case, this didn't work. But how often are you successful in reuniting these children with their families and convincing the families that their kids really aren't witches?
Well, the partner agencies that we work with, the Child Rights and Rehabilitation Network and Stepping Stones Nigeria, both had a great deal of success. A lot of the time, parents have abandoned children due to a combination of factors. It's not just the belief in witchcraft. Often, poverty will be a significant factor. So our partner NGOs will provide the parents with small grants or small loans so that they may be able to set up businesses and therefore care for the children. And also a lot of the time it's just a gradual process of making the parent aware of the fact that the child isn't actually a witch and that the child isn't going to bring unimaginable difficulties into their lives. Sometimes, you know, it can be done in 2 to 3 weeks. Sometimes it takes 2 or 3 years. But we have had quite a high success rate of reuniting children with their parents. And it really, you know, it makes me very hopeful that all of the children eventually one day can go back to their parents and be supported in living with them again.
Gary Foxcroft, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Peggy.
Gary Foxcroft runs the British charity Stepping Stones Nigeria. To find out how to see the BBC documentary Saving Africa's Witch Children, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. Let's stay in Nigeria and head to Lagos, where spring cleaning happens all year long. That's because it's the law, Sarah Simpson reports.
In the rundown Obalende district of Lagos, the whole neighborhood is set to work sweeping the roads. And John Ebiwari and his three small daughters have just finished the odious task of fishing plastic bags from the stinking open sewer gutters that run in front of his crumbling house.
I've been cleaning out the gutters and then cleaned my surroundings. Basically, that's what I've been doing, and I did my laundry. That's all.
D-
Do you do that every month then?
Yeah, every month. The last Saturday in every month, we do that all over the state, Lagos State.
Lagos State is entirely taken up by Lagos City, normally a bustling and frantic place. But for 3 hours on the last Saturday of each month, the city falls to a hush as entire families stay home and clean. It's actually a state law that residents must stay in their neighbourhoods and clean up on sanitation day. The most important job is unblocking the sewers. One of John's neighbours crumples her face at the rising stench as she removes waste with a long rake. Streets normally bustling with traders and food sellers are awash with soapy water. Even the young motorbike taxi men are out scrubbing and polishing up their vehicles until they gleam in the early morning sun. Street cleaners in orange uniforms are out in force pushing giant trash bins through the streets, gathering up refuse to be carted off to the city dump. Nojim Muritala uses a megaphone attached to the roof of a battered van to get his message across. He works for the Lagos Waste Management Authority and shouts in pidgin English that blocked gutters allow fetid water pools to build up. That's an ideal breeding ground for malarial mosquitoes. Muritala takes a break from the megaphone to explain that his team also shames non-participants into action.
We say that I will have to call them out and put most of the dirt in front of their house. To make them
if we see a dirty house, we'll put garbage in front of the door.
They are going to take them away or they lock their house.
And then we'll threaten to call the police, who will take them away and lock up their house.
The police Muritala refers to belong to a special stick-wielding unit who enforce sanitation day. They're called KAI, Kick Against Indiscipline. Commander Ayodele Ogunbiye is one of them. A few blocks away, he and his men are in action.
And it is not only sanitation day, that is the last Saturday of the month, that we do come out. We are out on every day because it's our job to ensure that the environment is neat.
Flames curl into the sky from a bonfire Ogunbiye and his men have set. They've smashed apart small wooden kiosks and set them alight. Their owners, petty traders who sold everything from Qurans and trinkets to snacks and drinks, can only watch from a distance as their livelihoods go up in thick black smoke. This is part of the dark side of Sanitation Day.
We are clearing all the shanties, kiosks, within the environs to make sure that this environment is beautified.
Ogunbiye and his colleagues explain that the kiosks were illegal structures, pulled down under their zero-tolerance policy. But this area is a favourite spot for the ruling party's political rallies, and it lies on a route often used by the state's governor. So it must look neat, Ogunbiye says. Back in the residential neighbourhood, groups of young men and boys make the most of the empty streets for a game of soccer. Until 10 a.m., when the streets come back to life and clean-up day is over for another month. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Simpson in Lagos, Nigeria.
And now some music to do your spring cleaning by. This is the title track from an album by an artist named Nice. It's called Gongo Aso, and it's sung in Yoruba, one of the indigenous languages of Nigeria, where the artist is from.
Shabby, I'll be
time to do some cooking. In South Africa, a favorite national dish is a colorful mix of vegetables and strong spices. In this latest installment of our series, What's Cooking?, reporter Kira Neal takes us to a kitchen in Johannesburg.
So I'm cooking chakalaka. It's a favorite gravy-based sauce of South African people.
Today, Sibu Mbata, a professional chef in Johannesburg, prepares his modern variation of this tomato bean curry at a friend's home. It is believed that chakalaka originated in mining camps in Johannesburg during the gold rush in the early 1900s. Migrant laborers mixed together whatever ingredients they had, adding curries and chilies for taste.
So I'm just now waiting for the pot to warm up, and then the games begin.
Sibu wears several thin bronze and copper bangles on his right hand. As he begins by finely chopping onions, they dance against his wrist.
I'm now going to grate the carrots. The carrot is crucial because it sort of makes the substance of it. Now I've just put the onion and carrot. Yeah, it's cooking down nicely. Can you see the beautiful colors you're creating, hey? Very nice.
What does it look like?
Well, it's orangey because of the carrots.
Next, he adds ginger and garlic.
You see, if you understand about how people eat, I think certainly from a sense of poverty, you've got to mix as much as you can so you can get the maximum of nutrition of whatever you've got, you see?
Sibu believes contemporary varieties of chakalaka are a testament to people's improved economic conditions since the end of apartheid.
The miners, I'm telling you that they couldn't even really afford all what I've got here to have all this variety of ingredients, you see? Because the classic is just tomato and onion sauce. That's what you can easily buy, you know?
Sibu hopes to create meals that inspire people to make healthy, exciting variations of traditional dishes. In this version of chakalaka, for example, he experiments with using a pickled ginger from Thailand and Worcestershire sauce.
Ah, this is my la piche de la résistance. It is my spice. It's a very mild curry.
Sibu then adds sugar, Worcestershire sauce, and vinegar to the carrot and onion mix, creating a very dense, tangy-smelling stew. The last step is to add canned tomatoes, baked beans, and green peas.
Now, how's the colors?
The complementary colors.
Red, orange, green, and a bit of pale yellow.
Sibu dishes out the chakalaka over pap, a white cornmeal slowly cooked to create a thick, creamy consistency like mashed potatoes. On the side is spinach, steamed with onions, and a peanut butter sauce.
And how do we eat it?
Well, you've got to eat it with your hands. This is traditional food. Hands.
We sit outside to eat under the shade of a jacaranda tree.
You combine a little bit of everything, and then you'll get one mouthful of a taste. That's the idea.
The chakalaka is sweet and salty. Sour and spicy all at the same time.
Enjoy. Bon appetito. It's like I'm Nandi.
And that's bon appetit in Zulu. For the World Vision Report, I'm Kira Neal, eating well in Johannesburg, South Africa.
To see photos of Chef Mbata in his chakalaka dish, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Nasima Santing.
And now, we hear from an African refugee living in Portland, Maine.
My name is Daniela Runyambo. I'm 17 years old. I speak very well four languages. I speak French. I speak Kiswahili. It's from Congo. I speak Kinyarwanda. It's from Rwanda. And I speak English. I try to speak English. I came to Portland, Maine as a refugee. I lived in Congo, but it was a war in Congo. In French, they say refuge, so a place where you can hide, you can feel more free. My first year in Portland High School, I didn't know any English, and I started like to zero. I was scared about it. I was like, okay, I'm going to go there. I don't know anything. And if I start talking, they're going to make fun of me. But that wasn't what I saw here. I make friends easily because I love to talk to everybody. When you are talking, it's easier to learn something new. But if you are shy, don't talk to anybody, you're not going to learn anything. Feel it. Enjoy it. Enjoy the language that you're learning. If you don't enjoy English, how can you learn it? If I go in Europe, I'm pretty sure that so many people know French and English. In every country in Africa, one of those people, all those people, knows Swahili. French, English, Swahili, those three languages all over the world know those languages. So I think I'm a blessed girl.
Nasima Santi kwa Mungu wangu. Nasima Santi kwa wema wako, kwa maana fadhili zako zadumu milele na milele. Amina.
It's a Christian song that say, I say thanks to the Lord because his love is pretty big. He loved me a lot and other stuff. So it's a song of saying about thanking God for all the things that he's done in my life. Yeah.
That piece was produced by Emily Eagle. Coming up, music from a Brazilian artist turned politician. You're listening to the World Vision Report. Stay with us.
Pedra dura, bate que fura, da pedra racha, tanto que racha, roxa que relaxa, frouxa que vira, areia do mar, tanto que areia arenga, que a sereia canta pelo pé, que areia pisar, olha que o samba foi, foi quebrando, foi, foi...
Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Gilberto Gil is one of Brazil's most famous musicians. He's been singing and winning awards for decades. Up until last year, he was Brazil's Minister of Culture, a post he held for 5 years. Now, Gil's got a new album, the first since he left his day job. The album was so good, it was nominated for a Grammy. Our guide to global music, Tendai Maposa, joins us now from Zimbabwe to talk about Gil's music. Tendai, good to talk to you again.
Yes, thank you, Peggy. It's always good to talk to you, too.
Well, I want to start off with some music from the new album. What do you recommend we listen to get a sense of his music and what he's all about?
Yeah, I think let's start with a song called Others Saw It, which is called Outros Viram in Portuguese, and it's off the album.
Rabindranath Tagore preferred a prophecy. Bold enough, he would say that Brazil is going to be a shore, a Florador, into another land, wonderland, yeah, 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 motherland, land of a man reborn on a mat made of sand.
Tendai, how would you describe this song?
Well, it's a classic bossa nova song. That's Gil and his guitar just by himself. I think it's beautiful.
Now, he went from being a really famous musician straight into politics. It's not often that that happens. But I'm curious as to why he was offered this post as Minister of Culture.
Because I think, like you rightly say, he was a famous musician. So some people blame President Lula's decision to appoint him Minister of Culture as a populist move. But Gil had been involved in politics for a very long time. Back in the 60s, when there was a military government in Brazil, he was actually arrested for being critical of that particular government. And he spent like 3 months in jail and then 6 months under house arrest. And then he joined the Green Party in 1988. He got appointed to different state positions. And then in 2003, President Lula asked him to become the Minister of Culture. So he was not exactly new to politics. He was always on about the environment, about the poor in Brazil, and conservation of the rainforest. So he was always an activist.
So what did he actually accomplish as Minister of Culture? How will he be remembered in that political role?
Well, for starters, he got the government to increase the budget of the Department of Culture by 50%. And he also got more than 650 cultural hotspots established. These are centers with computers, with broadband and software for free public use.
I'm wondering, because Brazil is also known for its huge favelas or slums, did Gil focus at all on that community when he served in the government?
He sure did. I mean, some of these hotspots are actually in the favelas. The hotspots are the places where people can go and make music, record music, or make film. And then, you know, they've got everything there.
Gil is one of Brazil's most famous musicians and has been for decades. Let's listen to one of his older songs to get a sense of what he's about. What would you recommend?
An old favorite of mine from 1979 called Toda Menina Baiana. Toda menina baiana tem santo que Deus dá. Toda menina baiana tem encanto que Deus dá. Toda menina baiana tem Toda menina baiana tem defeito também que Deus dá. Que Deus dê. Que Deus dá. Que Deus entendeu de dar.
So Tendai, what am I hearing in that music that is distinctly Brazilian?
The language, for starters.
Yes, the language. Do you know what it is he's saying in English?
I did ask a Portuguese person here, and they told me that it's a tribute to all women. All women are beautiful.
Oh, to all
basically.
Women. That's very good of him.
Basically, that's what you say it is. It might also like have something to do with women from his region, the region that he comes from, which is Bahia. She said to me, well, it's a tribute to all women. All women are beautiful.
Okay, so it's a tribute to women. And what about the rhythm or the instruments being used here?
The way he comes in with the guitar and also the percussion, it's a kind of a mid-tempo samba. There's an element of samba there. So that's how you would place it as Brazilian music.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to his new album and look at some of the ways he's pushing the boundaries of what he's done before. What song do you recommend?
There's a song here called Os País, and I really like this song. I like this song a lot because it's a fusion of Brazilian music and reggae. Gil was a champion of reggae music that became big when Bob Marley was making waves, and he was a major champion of this music. Da moça que expressa no andar provocante a força ondulante da sua moral, amor flutuante acima do bem e do mal.
Now, I understand he was really eager to leave politics and go back to music. I mean, it was a strange transition to go from a famous musician to politics, but he wanted out, and the president tried to encourage him to stay for a while, and he left anyway.
Twice he tried to resign from the ministry, as you rightly said, and President Lula only accepted his resignation on the third time. I think everybody who loves music all over the world really welcomes Gilles Beck with both arms.
Tendai, why don't we go out on one of his popular songs from the new album?
I would suggest a song called La Renaissance Africaine. This is about the hope of a rebirth of Africa after all the tribulations that this continent has been through.
Listen to that, and I'll say so long to you. Thanks again so much for being our music expert today.
Thanks a lot, Peggy. It was a pleasure as always.
L'homme et son paysage aimé, tout est là devant ses yeux, tout est dans les baobabs. La renaissance africaine, la renaissance africaine, et sa puissance.
Tendai Maposa is our guide to global music. Spoke to us from Harare, Zimbabwe. Fishing has long been a way of life for coastal villages in Mexico, but it's getting tougher to make a living that way. Conrad Fox spent the day with a fisherman on the coast of southern Veracruz, and he brings us this report.
On a rainy Monday morning, a small group of fishermen are gathered on the bank of a brackish river. Each is baling out a small canoe of roughly cut wood boards, patched over and over again with a thick, resiny-looking substance. Ermitario Martinez explains what it is.
This is the stuff they use for protecting TVs, stereos, so they don't get broken when they're being delivered. And that's what we use to patch the holes. We get a big piece of it and melt it down with gas or paint thinner, and we put it where the wood is rotting.
By the stuff for protecting TVs, he means styrofoam. They gather it from the garbage, an economical way to keep their frail boats afloat. Martinez and his companions head in their canoes to a lagoon, a short paddle from here. I sit awkwardly in the middle, bailing out the water that seeps in rapidly, using an old Coke bottle. Turning a bend, we enter Oyster Lagoon. The sun has come out now. Martinez gathers up a circular net with a long rope in the middle and lead weights around the outside edge. He scans the water intensely, then flings it out. He explains what he's doing.
I'm pulling it in slowly to feel if any fish bump against the net, but there's nothing, just this jellyfish.
No cayó nada. No cae.
And for 2 hours, there's nothing. Martinez says that for more than a decade now, he's watched not only fish, but oysters, shrimp, and crab in this lagoon get smaller and scarcer. These days, he barely makes $400 a month, just enough to feed his family. At 11 o'clock, Martinez suggests breakfast. He lowers himself slowly over the edge of the boat to look for oysters. The boat leans precariously to one side, and I expect him to suddenly disappear under the surface like a pearl diver. It turns out the water barely comes up to his waist. Martinez roots for oysters with his feet, which he pulls to the surface, opens with a knife, and eats with cold tortillas. As we eat, he tells me why he thinks the lagoon and his livelihood are dying. It's the fault of fishermen from other communities, he says, who spread nets across the mouth of the lagoon.
They grab everything and there's nothing left for us.
But in fact, there's plenty of blame to go around. A generation ago, people on the lake shores only caught what they could eat. But now fishing has become a business, with more than 1,000 people making a living from these waters. There's little regulation or oversight by authorities. As for the minuscule oysters Martinez is serving, they're in breeding season right now, a time when, scientists say, they should be left alone to grow. By the afternoon, the wind picks up. The waves rock the boat, making it difficult to throw the net. Martinez comes close to falling in. Then his luck begins to turn. A bit. Every few throws of the net brings in a fish or two. The biggest are no bigger than my hand. By about 2 o'clock, there's maybe 20 fish in the bottom of his bucket.
I guess we've got maybe a kilo and a half. Two if you count this jellyfish.
And by 3, the waves are unbearable. Martinez heads back, paddling against the wind with difficulty. When he gets home, his 4 children will sell the fish from door to door. It hardly seems worth the effort, but Martinez isn't dejected about the day's catch.
I've got 1 kilo to eat, 1 kilo to sell, and it didn't cost a thing. You're not lucky every day. But if you score 10 kilos, 5 kilos, then you've made it. You've come home even happier.
Back on shore, we roast his 3 biggest fish over a fire. They're not filling, but they are delicious. And, as Martino says, they cost us nothing. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox, by the edge of Oyster Lake, Veracruz, Mexico.
Earlier in the show, Will Everett brought us a story about Iraqis trying to get into colleges here in the U.S., and we heard briefly from a younger brother of one of them. Will struck up a friendship with 10-year-old Osama. Turns out he's an artist. Will sent us this reporter's notebook.
My name is Osama Ahmad. I'm 10 years old.
The first thing I noticed about Osama was that he was a really happy kid, a smiling boy with enormous brown eyes. He'd learned a little English from playing computer games and was eager to talk to a foreigner.
I've learned English by not books, but I've learned it by computers. So like that, I've started at a little 3 words or 4, then I've end by 100 words or more.
He especially liked playing American war games, but preferred strategy games to those with lots of bombs and bloodshed. His family had left Iraq when Osama was 6 because of the growing sectarian violence in their part of Baghdad. What Osama remembered most was the initial invasion. When I asked him what he wanted to be when he grew up, he said he once wanted to be an army officer, but he'd recently had a change of heart.
When I grow up, I start to think by be a general, then I change my mind to be an artist.
Painting was Osama's passion. His mother said that he comes home every day and loses himself in his paints. The family lives in a part of town inhabited by a lot of poor refugee families. I'd encountered some of their kids in the street, and they seemed wild and restless. I thought it was great that Osama had something constructive to do with his free time. And then he brought out his pictures.
Look, this is my paints. Look.
Oh, I see.
This is a game. It was like a hill and soldiers want to get to
As he flipped through the spiral notebook, I studied the scenes of carnage and destruction. The violence that he shied away from in his computer games had found expression in his art. Page after page showed crude helicopters dropping bombs on burning houses while people ran in terror, or bodies crushed under tanks.
My art is all wars. My mother tell me, all wars, just draw one flower. Can't you do that? I can't, just war. Only tanks and nothing else. I don't know what.
He wasn't trying to make a political statement or make the American guest uneasy. He simply drew what was on his mind, the images that had haunted him from early childhood and begged for expression.
This is a war by the Americans, hammers, fast bullets, and this is have a bombs in the air and they explode. It was a terrible thing.
Why do you want to draw pictures of terrible things?
Well, I don't know. This is all what I know. I draw pictures. I don't know why.
His mom didn't know either. The strange thing was he didn't seem haunted or damaged. He had a purpose in life, to be a painter, which was a lot more than could be said of the refugee kids I saw who loitered in alleys smoking cigarettes. When I went to find a taxi, they followed me, seeing a foreigner in their midst. They shouted epithets in Arabic and circled me like a pack of dogs. They were scary. But perhaps they were expressing the same buried trauma as Osama, but without the tools that he had at his disposal. As the taxi left and they receded from view, I thought, would a pen or a paintbrush make any difference to those kids? Then again, would it make any difference to Osama? Would it always be war, war, war? Or would he one day pick up his brush and paint the flower that his mother has wanted from him for so long?
Soldiers want to get to the other side. They drop a little things. I don't know what to call in English, but she's very hurt.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas. And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Simply go to our homepage at worldvisionreport.org and click on the Facebook or Twitter icons. And you can also comment on the show there. We're always interested in feedback. The program was produced this week by Sue Shepherd and Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber and Christina Darden are our producers. Doug Boyles and Mark Bandy are our audio engineers. Our interactive editor is Larry Short. And I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.